Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. Sort of like the play, Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden today? Sort of our version of Where's Waldo? Or Where's Carmen Sandiego? You know, there's a lot of speculation on what's happened to him. Some people think he's dead. Some people think he's still hiding somewhere along the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. What have you guys seen as you've read through the different information you get and the different tips that you get from people that are looking for him?
He's in Pakistan. If he were in Afghanistan, he'd be in big trouble because the United States Special Forces have carte blanche to go wherever they want in Afghanistan. They do not have that in Pakistan. And in the tribal areas, even the Pakistani government cannot go, although they're going there now because of the growing terrorism, Islamic terrorism threat coming out of those tribal areas. But when Pakistan was founded back in 1947, they simply continued the old law that the British had used, whereby the tribal areas, which were basically the Pushtun tribal areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the British told the Pushtuns, look, we won't try and impose our law on you. We'll pay off some of your more powerful chiefs, and you won't invade the areas we do control. The Pakistanis pretty much continued that, although they cut some of the payoffs a bit, not completely. And until recently, that's been the law of the land. So if you're going to hide somewhere, and you're highly respected by many of the Pushtun, you know, tribal peoples, you're going to hide in the Pushtun tribal areas. The Special Forces and American intelligence has tried with some success. We'll never know until it's over and somebody can write, you know, up the details. But apparently they have had some success using electronic and other intelligence to track Bin Laden's movements. However, it obviously has not been accurate enough for them to go in there and pop a Hellfire missile on him, which I'm sure they would do, even though many people would like to capture Bin Laden alive. I think right at any point, Bin Laden dead was, you know, preferable to no Bin Laden at all. But they haven't been able to get a close enough bead on him. The tribal leaders and Al-Qaeda leaders that have been killed in the last year or so since they've been going after them with the Predator, you know, UAVs and the missiles energetically, have been operating pretty much in the open. But from accounts that have gotten out from people who have seen Bin Laden over the last 8 years, he basically runs around with, you know, bodyguards, but he does it very discreetly and basically blends in wherever he settles down. And he's been very successful at it. But, you know, with the tribal areas now open to invasion by the Pakistani security forces, he's liable to get cornered and caught.
Now, one of his sons was just killed recently, right?
So it's said. I don't know if they have DNA evidence or not.
Yeah, but that's what the reports were.
Yeah.
Now,
not surprising. He uses family members for couriers. He stopped using, you know, cell phones a decade ago.
Right. Now, Austin, you wrote an article, what, about a year ago about what's happening to his organization and where he's at?
Well, I wrote an article that was really my 9/11 article for 2008. It's up on the Strategy Page On Point Archive, I think September 9th, but it was for the week of 9/11, 2000, the week that 9/11 fell in 2008. And really what I did was make the point that Bin Laden, he may have some influence still among some very, very extremist Sunni organizations, the Salafists, as the at one time CITCOM preferred to call them in preference to jihadist or even Islamist revolutionary, because they're an entire brand of Islamic revolutionary groups that are not they're not all associated with affiliated with Al-Qaeda by any means, and CITCOM's term Salafist was to try to pin down more closely the ideology that bin Laden represents, Qutubism, from Sayyid al-Qutub, the Egyptian theorist who really modernized, quote-unquote, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, which is where actually the roots of Al-Qaeda come from. Anyway, I was making a point that with the exception of those folks, and there are far fewer of them in 2008-2009 than were in 2001, I don't simply mean that there are fewer because many have been killed. They have been. But bin Laden didn't produce the caliphate, the great promise, I guess in a way I would put it, the divine promise. And that's really what, because he was mixing religion. Religion was his politics, and his politics were his religion. You know, this divine promise, it didn't gel, didn't come about, certainly didn't come about quickly, and you're back into a situation where virtually everyone can see that the United States is back in the Middle East in a bigger way than it had ever been. That's with Iraq. The U.S. Is in Afghanistan. The situation in Afghanistan, as Jim pointed out, is not at all favorable to Afghanistan. He is not quite ideologically dead, but I said ideologically rotting. And he can buy, as Jim pointed out, assuming he still is alive, and there are indications now that he is, he can buy protection with money and to some degree with prestige. I also want to point out there are rumors that he had been in Balochistan on the border down around Quetta or the like, not just in Waziristan and some of them, but the Baluchis are a large tribal area, if you want to. It doesn't mean like the federated tribal areas in Pakistan, but he was operating in that border area at one time. But this is, Dan, I'm not trying to be cute with this, this is a kind of death for him, this ideological rot. I will point out, too, the 2002 9/11 column I wrote, which is also up in the On Point section of the strategy page, I wrote an obituary for him. And it was, I won't say it was cheeky, it was an angry column, because I said, you know, the guy ought to be dust, you know, fed to the sharks and the like. And because he had disappeared largely for that year, and given the kind of ego he's got, I thought, you know, I think there's a good chance that he's dead. I believe I was wrong. This column still holds up from the point of view of American at war and recognizing many of the personal psychological traits that I think mark bin Laden, including that megalomania and an extraordinary ego. I commend that to Strategy Talk listeners to look at that. You'll get a little bit of a grin out of it, but there's still some, I think, valid points made in that column that was wrong on the presumption that he was dead. To get back to the 2008 column, part of the reason that he's lost is clearly U.S. and to a lesser degree Western counterattack on his supporters physically fighting in Afghanistan, also winning, and I underline that, in the heart of the Middle East, in Iraq, changing the dynamics between where you have choice in most places in the Arab Muslim Middle East, you're trapped between either terrorist or tyrant, and they both operate on terror, and that's not a choice. What you've got in Iraq is an emerging nightmare for someone like bin Laden, which is it's creaky, it's Iraqi good, to use the U.S. military slang for something just adequate enough or barely adequate enough, but it is an emerging Arab, predominantly Arab Muslim democracy. Kurds are also Muslims, but they're not Arabs. And there it is in the heart of the Middle East, and I guarantee you Al-Qaeda knows that is the kind of, it is like an ideological stake being shoved into Al-Qaeda's heart. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi recognized that in his now famous letter to the al-Qaeda leadership, probably sent to bin Laden, in late January, early February of 2008, which was intercepted. The courier was intercepted before he could get across the border, presumably moving from Iraqi Kurdistan into Iran, by the way, but he was caught. Parts of the material appeared in the New York Times rather shortly after the courier was caught. It wasn't announced at the time that the guy was caught in northern Iraq. That came to the press later that year, and not that it matters where he was caught, but there was the information, and Abu Musab Zarqawi's conclusion is that a democracy run by the Iraqi people, and there was a line in there, effectively, people of their own blood, meaning not the United States or a foreigner, but their own locals, was absolutely fatal to al-Qaeda's cause. And he was focusing on Iraq, but it's fatal to al-Qaeda's cause because it gives an alternative that is not an autocratic religious tyranny, and they're afraid of it. Those things have happened, Dan, over the last 8 years. It looks like a long time because we're in a long war, a long struggle at many different levels. But really, in the span of things, there's some remarkable changes, and they don't favor Osama bin Laden at all. He's trapped in a cave, and as Jim said earlier, you know, eventually a hellfire missile fired by a predator is likely, that's likely his gallows. I know why Jim thinks that's the case. I think I do. I know what mine is. I don't want to waste an American life going into a cave to get him. It's not worth the arrest. It's worth knocking him out, and let's just do it. I think there's a value to having a unmanned aerial vehicle and a guided smart munition do it instead of a Hollywood type thing with special forces. Just don't risk a guy's lives.
Now, Jim, the previous administration received a lot of criticism from the present administration that they had not caught Osama bin Laden. Was any of that criticism valid?
No, it was all politics. Obviously, Bush would have been extremely happy to have caught bin Laden, but he was confronted with the problem of Pakistani sovereignty. I mean, indeed, that's the one thing that Obama did say with a straight face, that he would be more aggressive in Pakistan. Now, there are problems in being more aggressive in Pakistan, but he was willing to take the chance, which Bush was not. Even before Obama got elected, Bush basically, you know, saw what was coming and told him, he said, okay, go ahead. What the hell? I got nothing to lose. I'm a lame duck. And this apparently is what Obama wants. And it wasn't that he was trying to take anything away from Obama, because Bush has remained very quiet since he left office, which I'm sure Obama is very, you know, happy about. Because Obama has taken over much of Bush's program against, you know, Islamic terrorism. The problem with Islamic terrorism is that it is as inept as many other things in the Arab world. The Arabs have enormous problems, which they are aware of. There's the Arab reform movement, which gets very little publicity in the West, but it's a big deal in the Arab world. In fact, one of its sponsors is, of all people, the Saudi royal family. And what its basic tenet is, we have a problem, and it's us. In other words, the problems are internal, not external. Now, for decades, for generations, Arab dictators, and let's face it, most of the Arab world is still run by dictators or monarchs. A monarch can be a somewhat more benevolent dictator, but you're basically talking about somebody who doesn't consult the people before he tells them what to do. And they have had problems, because a dictatorship tends to be corrupt, as is, you know, the Saudi monarchy, for example, because there's no feedback loop. There's no way for people to, you know, get justice for their grievances. I mean, this is what our Declaration of Independence was all about. Well, 200 years ago, we were basically ruled by a monarchy. We had grievances, and there was nobody to go to. And that's why one reason we had a revolution. democracies tend to be more efficient in that respect, even though democracies tend to be noisier and, to a in political sense, messier. But politics is messy. In the Arab world, they outlawed politics. You basically had no way to, you know, get justice for your grievances. But at the same time, the problems were still there. So who do you blame them on? You blame them on foreigners. Now, that's not something the Arabs have invented. It's a worldwide, you know, situation. If you're a dictator, you got a problem, blame somebody outside. And if you can pull that off, you're going to stay in power for a long time, which the successful dictators tend to do. The Arabs have realized that while that still may be popular to blame the foreign, blame Israel, blame America, blame Europe, whatever, it isn't solving the problem. And this is what Bush, I think, in the long term will get credit for going into Iraq. He basically said, in your face, guys, this is where the problem is. He couldn't invade Saudi Arabia, where most of the, you know, the 9/11 perpetrators came from. But Iraq was wide open. It was just like more, almost as much as Syria. Syria was the real den of, Arab terrorists, and had been for decades, where they could hide out. They could plan. As long as they didn't do any dirt in their sanctuary, they could do whatever they wanted. And this is what Iraq was. Indeed, there was no secret that some of the bombers, some of the people responsible for the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, escaped to Iraq. It was an open secret, so to speak. And it's since come out that Saddam was, if not cozy with Al-Qaeda, willing to work with them, which Islamic terrorists have always done with any country they could basically get sanctuary. When you're looking for sanctuary, you basically don't try and vet, you know, the guy who's offering it. They're all thugs to one degree or another, and if he's willing to play, you know, by your rules as far as sanctuary go, you go there. And that's where members of Al-Qaeda were. Now, this got pushed out of the public purview because it was not politically correct, you know, once Iraq was invaded. But this is basically the problem. And by going into Iraq, all the Arab countries in the Middle East who supported Islamic terrorists had to confront the blowback. Saudi Arabia suddenly had bombs going off in its own territory, which had never happened before. And this was a direct result
It had gone off, but they were attacking American targets. Now they were attacking Saudi.
Well, yes, the Khobar Towers, but that was Iran. There were no Arab sanctioned, you know, attacks, as it were.
Except
for the ones in '79, which were a direct attack on the Saudi royal family.
Yeah.
But the '79 attacks basically brought about the Great Compromise, which was one of the pillars of modern Islamic terrorism. The Saudis say, we want to make peace, we don't want all this this disunity, and especially in our kingdom. And they basically gave the Islamic fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia, which had always been there. Indeed, the Saud family got into power in 100 years ago by having an alliance with the Wahhabi, you know, sect. That deal with the devil, so to speak, in the late 70s, early 80s, basically turned into an Islamic terrorist recruiting system. They basically turned the schools, the educational system, over to Islamic fundamentalists, and suddenly it wasn't a big deal to study engineering or any of these decadent Western curriculums, but to study religion, Islam. And if you study Wahhabi Islam, you're basically learning to hate people who aren't Muslims.
Now, let me make a point on what Jim did, elaborating on, he said, calling them all thugs, but also talking about the situation in Syria, in Iraq, the sewer of illegal arms, terrorists, and the like. That's an elaboration of when I talk about the choicelessness facing most of the Arab Muslim world between either tyrant or terrorist. And there's very little difference between them. Iraq breaks that mold. Now, of course, it's not an absolute mold. There are various different. There's a lot of differences in many of the Arab states. But that sense of choicelessness is an affliction that had had encouraged the Islamist radicals and Bin Laden. Make another point about the Arab reform movement. Jim's right about the Saudi royal family, or at least elements of it, picking up on it now, but there were some lonely voices, predominantly out of among Syrian intellectuals that were expatriates, Lebanese and Egyptian intellectuals, saying, hey, look at ourselves. Don't play the ruler's game of blaming the foreigner. Look at our own political and cultural issues. And I tell you what, that took a lot of guts. That's real scholarly and academic and intellectual spine to do what those folks were doing. Now that's a little bit more acceptable. I happen to think one reason the Arab reform movement has gotten more recognition is that Iraq. You ask Jim, you know, what about Bush and the like. I think Iraq's slow, bloody, brutal, but emerging success is an encouragement to those who said, look at the deep problems that we have. In a terrible way, Iraq is trying to it is addressing those deep issues.
Well,
also, let me make one other point too.
Okay,
is that when you say you know, Jim's saying, well, you couldn't go after Saudi Arabia, you could go after Iraq. Remember, we were locked in a cold war with Saddam. If you go back and look at UN Security Council Resolution 687, which in the Desert Storm, Saddam was in violation of specifics as well as the spirit of 687. And the question after 9/11 is do we continue to try to manage this double containment of Iran and Iraq? Can we do it with Bin Laden exciting so many disenchanted young Muslims? Is Saddam going to slip the noose? Did 687 mean anything? And I think this is ironic because Bush gets attacked so much as not caring about the UN. In a lot of ways, what comes off in Operation Iraqi Freedom is an enforcement mechanism for UN Security Council Resolution 687. There are a lot of people who just go up the wall when I make that point. But take a look at it, read the resolution, and look at the dynamics carried out through the end of Bush 1, through the Clinton administration, and into Bush to the George W. Bush's administration. We had to end that war, is my view, is that cold war, that slow war with Saddam.
Right. Now, one of the things that is going to make Iraq different than the other Arab countries is as their university system becomes stronger, they're going to be producing a lot more technicians and engineers, you know, and other people that is going to probably make them the intellectual capital of the Arab world, right?
They always were.
Yeah.
Baghdad has for almost over 1,000 years been a center of Muslim, you know, scholarship, and in particular Muslim secular scholarship. Egypt has been the center of the clerical scholarship, so to speak. And Baghdad after World War II did not, as it happened in Saudi Arabia, allow the education to be taken over by Islamic fundamentalists, which has been a problem in the Arab world since medieval times. We tend to forget that, you know, the Arabs like to say, well, the West got all of the ancient wisdom from, you know, the Arab translations, but what they forget to mention is that stopped about the time that the European Renaissance began. You know, if you think about it, say, well, gee, what happened? Why didn't they keep going? It stopped because there was one of the many backlashes by Islamic fundamentalists that this modern knowledge was un-Islamic. That is nothing new. It's been going on for 1,000 years. And if you look into, you can find it on the web, you know, detailed, you know, histories of the Arab world, you'll see this coming up again and again. You know, modern science, whether it's 19th century, 18th century, 16th century, there's a backlash from the clerics, and it gets shut down. The Baghdad and Lebanon, And there was another place where there was a lot of activity. Oh, Palestinians, believe it or not.
No, Palestinians have a high degree of education.
Exactly.
And
they were the ones producing the Arab engineers. But what got the Arab reform movement going was, even with that, the achievements of the Arab world in technology, in literature, in other words, in all the benchmarks of, you know, a modern, what we call a modern post or industrial civilization, they were at the bottom. I mean, they were just above sub-Saharan Africa, which is not saying much, because the Arabs had so much. They have oil wealth, they have thousands of years of literacy and civilization. Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, has none of that, or very little of that. So the Arabs, it began to sink in. My God, since World War II, we have gone nowhere. We have all this oil wealth, and you have countries like Taiwan, which, you know, 40, 50 years ago, all these tigers in East Asia, these small, South Korea, Taiwan, the Thailand, you know, Indonesia, they were all behind the Arab world economically. Now they're way ahead of them. And it's finally struck, it's been hitting, you know, the Arab intelligentsia, you know, for the last couple of decades, especially since the Cold War ended. It's just, my God, we've done nothing. What's wrong? Why, we should be, you know, in the vanguard. And we're nowhere. And of course, this is very unpopular to say, because one of the problems in the Arab world, they have this, it's a cultural thing, this narcissism, that, hey, we are the greatest. Now, granted, self-esteem has been a big deal in educational, Western educational circles for, you know, several decades. But the basic problem is self-esteem can be self-defeating. If you have too much self-esteem where no esteem is really should be, where you have problems and you say, well, hey, we're the greatest, forget about it, that is a recipe for disaster. And if you want to see how badly that plays out, look at the Arab world. But they are aware of it. The problem is, how do you overcome decades, generations of propaganda where you're saying, we're the greatest, we're your greatest, then you have to stand up and say, well, you know, folks, I got bad news. We're not the greatest. And that, politically, that's dynamite.
See,
it'll
blow up
in your face.
To get
literally.
Back to our subject, Bin Laden was one of these voices of saying, we're the greatest. You know,
And if you don't agree with me, I'll kill you.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And that's it. You know, we're the greatest, and if you disagree, you're dead. You know.
Right.
Well, that in a way, Jim just used the term narcissist. Wow. That's good work.
Yeah. Now, with Al-Qaeda...
Necro-narcissism.
Right.
Yeah.
With Al-Qaeda extremely diminished and basically Osama, you know, shut down, has something sprung up to replace him?
There are wannabes out there. There are no questions about it. But what you've seen is there's still degrees of cooperation between some of these front groups. Lashkar-e-Taiba, you know, the Kashmiri Islamist group does cooperate with the Pakistani Taliban and indirectly with the Afghan Taliban and through with Al-Qaeda. But is there an iconic leader like bin Laden? No, Zawahiri doesn't have that kind of pizzazz. As a matter of fact, when Zawahiri comes out, I'm talking about Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was the really so-called Al-Qaeda number two in some way, so he's really, in my view, something more than...
Let's put it this way. There are Al Sharptons, but there are no Napoleons.
That's neat. I like that. That's a good configuration. They're wannabes, to use another street term. You know, they're wannabes, but this is... look, this is a long, tough, brutal struggle. I know that folks say that all the time. But the struggle is not only between the United States, West, however you want to figure that, and quote-unquote this idea of Islamic caliphatism, Salafism, or whatever. The struggle, as Jim has pointed out, is within the Arab world, is within Muslim countries. There's struggles going on in the West, too, with France, with its own quote-unquote, and without throughout Europe, with quote-unquote integrating Muslim communities, you know. Those are all aspects. To say it's a mosaic is the wrong way, because it's so dynamic. It's more kind of like a kaleidoscope. But the thing is, though, is there's no iconic leader who has replaced bin Laden. Maybe Zawahiri wanted, Zarqawi wanted to do it, but he got hit with, what, Jim, was it a 500-pound JDAM or something like that? I think that's what.
Well, he apparently got turned in by his own people who just got tired of his
attitude. They're ribbon with their own in interior factions. This isn't going away, Dan, and I'm not sitting here saying, you know, philosophies discredited. No, their ideology, it's still, it got some ideological appeal, but you ask if bin Laden was dead or alive, he hadn't been replaced, and I'll tell you what, I do think he's rotted.
He's a simple
place to end, you know?
Right. Yep, I think that's a great place to end. We'll talk to you next time, gentlemen.
Bye, guys.
Take care.
Bye.